And you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. It is Tuesday, July 13th, 2021, says the calendar. Well, the calendar doesn't say the year, but I'm assuming it's still 2021. I'm live in the studio today with Sigrid Schmaltzer. Hi,
hello.
Sigrid. Sigrid is a friend and teaches Chinese history at UMass and history of science.
That's right.
And how'd you get here today, Sigrid?
By bicycle.
Oh.
Yes.
Thank you.
I had to, you know, live up to the example.
Let's see. All right, there. I was moving up the wrong slider. Now I think I got your voice a little bit better. So yeah, we're going to talk about China, sustainability, trash, plastic, things like that. Oh, and you're also involved with Science for the People.
That's right.
What is that? Can you just say briefly?
Science for the People is an organization. It arose in the very late 60s as an anti-war movement of scientists and engineers fed up with their research being made to serve militarist purposes. And it was revived recently. It's now a big, exciting organization again. And we have a awesome magazine. Our most recent magazine issue is on racial capitalism and science. So if you check it out, scienceforthepeople.org, that's one of the main things I'm involved in. And we have a local chapter here in Western Mass. We put on, you know, community workshops and various events and have weekly discussions. And yeah, cool. Welcome to check it out.
Cool. Yeah, Sigrid lives in Northampton. We know each other through, I don't know, the food co-op originally through the 8 High Street food co-op or the vigil, the peace, the anti-war vigil, peace vigil.
And so many ways
on Saturdays.
Yeah,
Anyways. Yeah. So you're a professor of Chinese history. Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up?
Yeah.
Mainly New York City, also some southern New Hampshire.
How'd you get interested in Chinese history?
It's funny. Everybody who studies Chinese history has a story about this because we do get asked this question quite a bit. And my answer is, and I think it's true in addition to being the thing I always say, in eighth grade, I had this amazing world history teacher who was a specialist in Chinese history. And so I had that, you know, introduction, but I was also growing up in an atheist home and in an environmentalist home. And for me, I think there was something exciting about what I saw in ancient Chinese history, especially the philosophy of Taoism, seemed to me to be a way of finding a spiritual meaning in nature that was compatible with science and that didn't require me to believe in God or anything like that. And so for me, you know, in eighth grade, that's what China meant to me. And I would say it's very, very common for Americans, probably for other Westerners as well, to come to China with an idea, you know, that China is somehow going to fill a gap, you know, in our own culture, something that's wrong with our culture, something that our culture isn't giving us, and we think that China is going to solve that problem for us. And so it's a beautiful motivation, but I've also learned over the decades to be somewhat self-reflective and critical of that impulse as well, because it's a lot to shoulder any culture with that they're responsible for fixing yours.
When did you first go to China? What was that first trip like?
So I first went in 1994. I was actually at that time I was living in Japan for a year teaching English. And that was a kind of a coincidence that I happened to have that opportunity. My real interest was China even then. And so it just meant that I was closer and was able to get over there. So I was able to visit twice, once with a friend, and then I went back again by myself. And it was really in that trip. So at that time I was 22 years old. And you know, China was a very different place then. There were a lot more bicycles, that's for mm-hmm. sure. Literally weeks before I first went, they had started phasing out the what was called the foreign equivalency currency. It was like a that's not quite the right acronym. But it was basically money that foreigners were supposed to use instead of the money that, you know, the Chinese people were supposed to use. I mean, like, literally, that's how separate it was. That's how kind of unusual you felt going around China as a foreigner at that point. But I went that second trip when I was going by myself. I had just picked out of the Lonely Planet guide this place that said that it was great for independent backpacker type travelers. It's a place called Yangshuo, which is in the southwestern province of Guangxi, which has these beautiful mountains, the kind of mountains that very iconic, that you must have seen a lot of, you know, ink paintings of, that go straight up out of the, you know, very vertical, kind of, they come out, they're karst as the geological term, and they come directly out of the plain. They're very striking and beautiful. And so I went to go see those, and I made the most important relationship, really, that in my entire career in China, I made in that trip, because I was sitting in this little cafe that was designed for, you know, Western independent backpacker travelers. And this woman came up and sat down next to me, and she was, you know, clearly about the same age as me. And she asked if I wanted a tour guide. And I had just been in this mentality, like, you just say no to everything that, yeah, you know, people are asking you to do and, you know, selling you services, you know. And I told her, and she asked me this in English, and I said, you know, to her in Chinese, oh, no, because I had, you know, 2 years or whatever it was of college Chinese. So I was, you know, very arrogant. I was like, I don't need a tour guide. I speak Chinese. And she said, oh, okay, no problem. And, you know, started speaking Chinese with me. And she said, we could just hang out. And so we started talking. And then she showed me this little book that she had where people had written comments about, you know, what it was like to travel around with her as a tour guide. And I started reading them just to be polite. And I thought, I'm about to make the biggest mistake of my life, because here is this person who comes from a rural household in, you know, this amazing area, and who can, you know, is offering to bring me to her village. And I'm saying no, because why? Because I'm too arrogant or something, you know, or suspicious or something. And so I fortunately realized that I was about to make a big mistake. And I said yes instead of no. And she took me to her village and introduced me to her family. And I had, you know, meals at her house, and I stayed over in her house. And, you know, I used the toilet in the pigsty, which is where the toilet was, which was like a total eye opener to me. Like, you know, I mean, in so many ways, and we could talk about that. I mean, that has to do with sustainability and recycling too, right? I mean, the basic idea is that you want to have the toilet in the same place, you know, you want to collect the wastes, right? Like, you're using manure to fertilize the fields. It makes sense to have the manure collected in one place. So that's a typical place for a pigsty to be in Chinese villages. Another place that could be, it'd be the kitchen, right? Because then they can eat the food wastes, and, you know, they're you know, collected in that way. Anyway, so it was this phenomenal experience. And then I go back there all the time. We have kids the same age. So last time I went to China, I was able to introduce my kids to her kid. Things have changed a lot in that area. It's much, much more urbanized now, and it's become, the town of Yangshuo is now a major tourist destination for people in China, domestic tourists in China. It's huge. It's just this huge metropolis now. My friend actually has an apartment in town, but she, you know, her family still lives in this village. So amazing an experience. And then she was able to introduce me to people in my more recent academic book, which is on agricultural technology in recent Chinese history. She was able to introduce me to all sorts of people to interview. And she remains, you know, my deepest connection to rural China. So yeah, that's the story of my first trip to China, mm-hmm, which is still so important to me. Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. You've mentioning books, you know, you've written a few books, a number of books. Mm-hmm. I think what, Red Revolution, Green Revolution?
Red Revolution, Green Revolution. That's the one I was just talking about. Yeah. Okay. Agricultural technology.
Okay. Yep. What are some of the other books you've written?
Well, my first book was is called The People's Peking Man, Popular Science and Human Identity in 20th Century China. My partner Winston always says that academic titles always have to first have a stupid pun or alliteration, and then there's a colon, and then there's a boring description of the project. So I'm afraid all my titles fit that fit that pattern. But that book was on basically how the story of human evolution was told in the socialist era in China in particular, and also in other parts of the 20th century, and also how in China during the Mao era, there was this idea that people shouldn't just be the kind of recipients of scientific knowledge, but should actually participate in scientific knowledge, and that was called mass science. They like participate in the production of knowledge and scientific research. And that theme is also carried on to my second academic book, which is the Red Revolution, Green Revolution book, which looks at how scientists and so-called educated youth and farmers and state officials all participated in the production of agricultural knowledge.
That's cool. Well, the most recent book that you've given me, which isn't by you, but it's by a colleague, Joshua Goldstein, yeah, is called Remains of the Everyday, A Century of Recycling in Beijing.
Yes.
So I've started to read this, and I really appreciate a lot of the points it makes. Especially, you know, one of the things that really sticks with me about that book is how used to be there was a value of thrift. We valued thrift, mm-hmm, in this country and, you know, other countries. And now it's like we value disposability. We look down upon thrift.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Can you, how did we get there? I don't know if you can answer that question, but
well, it's funny. It's actually, so this book is really near and dear to my heart. The author, he wasn't a classmate of mine, but he was ahead of me in that same program. So we're connected by the same graduate program. And I actually had the opportunity to review this book for the publisher before it was published. And so I had this kind of sneak peek into it. So it's the book that's near and dear to my heart for a bunch of reasons. But I remember, just speaking to your specific question, I wrote a note when I was giving him comments via the publisher. I said something about how there was this way in which thrift has become, it's become kind of cute, you know, in our society. So you're right, like we value disposability, but then if we're enlightened, we value thrift, right? And we get, mm-hmm, this, like, you know, kind of emotional satisfaction when we take our shoes to the, you know, person to fix them instead of throwing them away, or when we do, you know, just a little tiny bit of, you know, a free pile, right? Like, yeah, and get something like that. And then we feel really good about ourselves. And it reminds me actually a conversation I had with your colleague, Ethan, who's doing this dissertation on recycling and doing kind of a participant observation with the pedal people. And he talks about like the emotions that people attach to the feeling of recycling and how they feel really good about themselves and that kind of thing. And so that really resonates for me. It's like we're in a society now where we really value, I would totally agree with you, we really value disposability. It's like we're hooked on the disposability, right? But then we convince ourselves that we're, some of us, right, convince ourselves that we're really living in this very good way because we occasionally take our shoes to the shoe fix, or the shoe fix is what it's called, the place that's near us.
Yeah, and feels so like countercultural and like rebellious and like the righteous rebellion to like fix something.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And typically, I mean, you know, you live much closer to those values than most of us. But for, I think, most of us, those, not to put it down, I mean, I think those are important acts of resistance, right? But we have to also recognize how large the stream of waste is on top of which these small, you know, victories of being able to reuse something or salvage something from a, yeah. you know, from the garbage or yeah. whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The big picture is so big.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. My guest today is Sigrid Schmalzer, who's a professor of Chinese history at UMass. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Tuesday from 3 until 4, followed by Madness Radio. Sigrid and I are going to keep talking about some stuff. Another point that this book, Remains of the Everyday, makes is just really trying to drive home how this big picture, how like these individual actions, you know, the corporations laugh and gloat.
Totally.
So this book also makes me think of the movie Plastic China that we both saw. Do you want to talk about that movie at all?
I'd love to talk about that movie. So, and actually the timing, you know, so we saw that movie right after I had reviewed the manuscript for Remains of the Everyday. And so for me, it was really fresh and the connections were just really alive. And then you were on the kind of little panel of discussants after the movie and really brought the questions of Plastic China, that Plastic China raised home to us here in Northampton. So the movie, the book, I should say, the book is a century of recycling in Beijing. So it begins in the early 20th century and takes us all the way up until today. The movie Plastic China is a recent film that it takes place in this one village where just about every household has adopted as their kind of main livelihood the recycling of plastic waste that's coming in mostly from other countries, including the United States, and actually doing the actual recycling, the actual taking that plastic and turning it into what do you call it? I can't even remember the plastic stuff that then gets made into mainly, you know, plastic
pellets,
junk.
plastic beads or pellets,
right? And then that's made into all sorts of a lot of junk that we buy, can then purchase in the form of keychains and whatever else it gets made into. And it's a extremely poignant movie. It focuses on, it really sees most of it through the eyes of this one, I think she's an 11-year-old girl, and the other children in the household. And she's actually from another family that has migrated there from elsewhere, not totally legally is the implication. And she spends her days sorting through this plastic so that it can be fed into this process. And you see really the devastation of the environment in that village. You see scenes of the families going and trying to and getting fish out of the stream, which undoubtedly used to be, you know, clean enough to have good living fish in it. And now, you know, there's dead fish floating right next to where they're, you know, finding fish to eat.
And the kids just like scooped up the fish in a bowl. They were so dazed or near death.
Yeah.
Like, oh, look how easy, we caught fish for dinner.
Exactly. So it's really painful to watch in a lot of ways. And it, you know, it marks a moment in China, in kind of the China-U.S. relationship as well, because for a long time, I think, you know, even, you know, kind of good liberal people in the United States, they have had this idea that, you know, China is the source of all of this contamination, right? And the best thing you can do for the planet is don't buy anything from China. I mean, remember that? That was maybe 10 years ago. That was the, you know, 15 years ago that I feel like was the height of that kind of, you know, not buying from China was this really kind of positive intervention you could make as an American. And then there were the scandals, you know, around, you know, the poisoning, you know, the use of melamine in as an additive in pet food that was causing, I think it was kidney failure in pets or some kind of major health, you know, deadly health problem for pets. So all of these things that I think gave people this idea that China was the source of the contamination that we were consuming, like China's poisoning us, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, in recent years, China has the state, the, you know, the government in China has really sought to turn that narrative around, in part by changing the rules about what kinds of waste they're willing to take from the United States. So this was part of the context that we were talking about, you know, Plastic China in, and also the context in which Plastic China, the movie, was created in China. It was during that same time when the government was changing those rules and really kind of trying to bring attention to the ways in which it's not like China's just poisoning other countries, right? The U.S., all of this plastic waste, a lot of which has not been sorted properly and contains all kinds of contaminants. You should talk more about this because I, mm-hmm. you know this way better than I do. But, you know, basically bringing consciousness to the ways in which China is being poisoned and the Chinese people are being poisoned by the waste that's produced by consumer societies in the United States and elsewhere.
Yeah, as a trash hauler, I really appreciated seeing that movie because, you know, I'm handling the waste in one step of the process. One little step of the process is goods go from being mined to stores to homes to landfills or incinerators or China, wherever. Anyway, so it was really touching to see this family sorting the plastic things that American consumers have dumped there, essentially. And because I don't know what happens to a lot of the things after mm-hmm. I, you know, pass them on to their journey. But one of the things that really struck me, so the family that has this little family business of recycling, they're trying to get an easier life. They're like hustling real hard. Everybody in the family's hustling, trying to get, you know, a better life. Then the dad, you know, you see him going to the doctor with tumors in his side mm-hmm. or something like that, all these health problems from the toxins. But they're trying to move up in consumer society.
Right.
And like the most poignant part of the film for me was, you know, their truck broke down that they go to collect, you know, the plastic in, or that they, whatever they use for transporting the plastic. So they're, you know, looking for a new car and they just want to achieve the dream, you know, mm-hmm. and they go to this auto show and they're, you know, pretending like they own a fancy car. But the 11-year-old, like, she goes in the auto show. There's like women, like models and, you know, just decked out in skimpy clothing, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just trying to sell this image and sell sex, sell cars. And she's just like, she comes from the country in a real life of catching fish in the river. And she's just like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And that just look of like the culture clash of what she's experienced up to that point. And then this world that we've created with values that go beyond human realness. Yeah, that was the most striking part of that thing to me.
That was definitely a heartbreaking scene. And I think the characters of the, you know, the family who own the business, right? And who, you know, you could see it. The film is very artistically done and it doesn't hit you over the head with an analysis. It just shows you kind of pictures and, you know, you can interpret it in different ways. But, you know, you could see that those business owners as really exploitative, right, of the family that comes from, you know, from afar and who are in this, you know, very precarious legal situation. This is the girl's family, you know, who's working for the boss, right? But you could see them as exploitative, but the life that they're living is, you know, is extremely harsh. And so then also you could see, I had to struggle with myself, you know, having this kind of judgmental feeling like, ugh, they're so, you know, so materialistic. All they want is this car, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But honestly, it's like your village has been trashed. There's dead fish floating in your river. Your life is, you know, sorting this plastic and you know, feeding it into these processes that are these chemical baths. I mean, it's really toxic process to create these plastic beads out of, I mean, recycling, like what, you know, then saying like, there's all of this feeling, you know, good feeling when, you know, you feel really good about it when you put the bottle in the recycling and, you know, to see the other end of that and the, you know, how that's then being processed is really eye-opening. And just to say like, what, you know, what do you aspire to when you're village has been wrecked that way? Like, what is, you know, you're not going to aspire to, you know, a rose garden and a leisurely, you know, retirement in a, I mean, there's, of course, you're going to aspire to what you can purchase out of the consumer society that's feeding the, that very life that you're living, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to come back to this. I have a Petal People story I might want to share too. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I'm here with Sigrid Schmaltzer, professor of Chinese history at UMass and a neighbor friend in Northampton. And this is Buffy St. Marie. That was Buffy St. Marie. Welcome back to Out There here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm Ruthie Wardring, and my guest today is Sigrid Schmalzer, a professor of Chinese history and history of science at UMass and lives here in Northampton and also involved with Science for the People. We've been talking about China and trash and stuff like that. I was reminded, Sigrid, of a little trash story from yesterday, so I'm a trash hauler. This week, the trash has been very heavy. There's a lot of water that's been in the trash from all the rain, a lot of water getting shipped to the incinerators, and water getting encapsulated in the landfills. But anyway, so pedal people, you know, we pick up trash, recycling, and compost in Northampton, Leeds, East Hampton. And most of our customers have chosen to be our customers. They could choose a trucking company, but most of them have chosen us. But some customers, they're tenants in a landlord-owned building, and the landlord signs up for pedal people service, and the tenants, you know, they might not, they just might be ambivalent or might be caught off guard, like, pedal people, what, who, what, wait. Anyway, so I had one of those situations yesterday where it's a relatively new customer. They've only been around for a few months, and a multifamily. And so I went for the pickup. I was subbing for someone else. And so they had like four barrels, like 30-gallon barrels along the side of the house, right underneath the drip line. I don't know how many inches of rain it's rained this week, but there was like 20 inches in the barrels, or at least one of them, because the lid had come off because it was overflowing with trash, which had knocked the lid off. Plus it's warm, and you got like literally like lots of drowned maggots in the water and all that slop. Anyway, so I was kind of feeling a little late already. It was getting towards the time of day when the transfer center closes. And I was trying to get all the trash there on time because I really don't want to take that stuff home with me. Oh, God. And so I was trying to, you know, I rode up on the scene and I was like, okay, this is my job, do your job. And I'm trying to, you know, pack garbage bags. And one of the tenants came outside and says to me, wow, thanks for taking that stuff. And I said, sure. And he said, we have a lot of stuff. And I said, yeah. And he was like, well, I should also say that the trash, it was all trash. Like we provided recycling totes, or totes were provided for recycling, and as well as a compost bucket, but the trash, it was just, you know, cans, bottles, everything mixed into the trash with like food residue and takeout, leftover rotten takeout food and stuff. Anyway, so he said something like, yeah, we used to have a dumpster before the new landlord bought the place. And he said, yeah, we could just throw it all in. And I tried to explain, well, with pedal people, I was going to say, well, like the city ordinance says the recycling is mandatory, blah, blah. But then I didn't want to come across as saying, this is the law and you better obey the law. I should also say, like, on that account, one of the notes on the account said something like, the tenants are native Spanish speakers. Communication might need to be in Spanish, or there might be challenges with communication. Anyway, so I was sort of expecting a little bit of like cultural challenges. And it was a person of color. And he said, at one point he said, well, maybe I could take the trash to the restaurant where I work. And I'm thinking, no, you shouldn't have to, like, a tenant should have a place to put their trash. You know, totally. That's the landlord and the trash hauler's responsibility to deal with the trash.
Right.
From like a sanitary perspective or whatever. But then I'm also like, but also, like, can you separate out some of this stuff? But I didn't really say anything. Oh, here's another funny part of the story. I had pulled out some of the aluminum because some of the bags were ripped. Animals had gotten into them. Mm-hmm. And so some of the aluminum cans that were on top, I like pulled to the side and put in a different tub. And when I reached for one of the cans, it was actually a beer can that was still full, hadn't even been opened. Mm-hmm. And so when the tenant came out, I said, oh, someone put this in the trash, do you want it? And he says, oh, that was left in my car, but I can empty it for you. And so I gave it to him, and he opened it and drained it. And then I was like, oh, I shouldn't have said anything. I could have taken that and given it to somebody. Anyway, then when I was leaving, he was like, oh, can you take this too? And he had this cardboard box from a 50-inch TV. And so I was like, oh, sure, just flatten it. I'll take that. Anyway, so it kind of brought up some things with me, like how do you address this microcosm of a lot of trash being made on an individual consumer level, mm-hmm. in the context of like global capitalism and environmental racism and all these huge injustices way better than one maggoty pile of trash.
I mean, that's a story that it touches on all of those questions, right? I mean, it makes us have to think about those big questions, because you're two people standing there having the conversation, and yet you can't get away from the fact that you are, you know, each like embedded in this much bigger system, and, you know, potentially have really different positions in that, you know, and different access to power and different kinds of privilege and all of that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I mean that you could say the same thing for like the experience, like the anecdote I told of, you know, meeting my friend Fung, you know, in that coffee shop. I mean, we're on one hand, we're like two people sitting there, right? And then on the other hand, we are coming with these extremely different life trajectories, and we are living in the same world, but have such incredibly different, you know, we're consuming different amounts. We are subject to the consequences of consumption in really different ways. And, you know, it's a lot for two people to have on their shoulders while they're trying to have a human interaction, right?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about things that China does that, like, less wasteful ways that they do things. Like, you talked about in agriculture. Well, you talked about the pig, mm-hmm. the pig's, what do you call it? The pig manure, and the human waste. Can you give some other examples of ways that China has some things figured out regarding waste?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, so China's a big place, and it has a long history, and so there's a lot of diversity, you know, in terms of the place and the time period and all kinds of things. But the project that I'm working on now, I'm calling it, well, and again, it's like the title, right? But Heritage and Survival. Right? It's not a stupid pun or alliteration this time, so maybe I give myself bonus points for that. But Heritage and Survival, the Power of Agricultural Knowledge in the People's Republic of China. And I am looking, in the process of doing this research, I am looking at a bunch of different examples of agricultural knowledge, and many of them do, I mean, because survival, right, and heritage, these are the themes, so it's really about thinking about how you mobilize knowledge that people have, a lot of which has been around for a long time, and mobilize that knowledge in order to sustain our society moving forward. So one of the examples that people in China have been very enthusiastically reviving in recent years is called the dike pond system. So this is a system where you have fish ponds, and it's, you know, it's typically in the southeast where the land tends to be very waterlogged, and so it was not particularly good for farming anyway. And people in these areas figured out that they could really turn a better profit. So there was actually a profit, you know, kind of a profit lens going on even then. If they dug out the land and turned them into fish ponds and piled the land up around in dikes and then planted the dikes. And the kind of most iconic example of this, where people kind of look back and say this is an example of like almost like an ecological thinking, is where they then planted those dikes with originally fruit trees, but then as the silk industry picked up, they planted it with mulberry trees, and then you feed the mulberry leaves to the silkworms because that's what silkworms eat, and then the silkworm feces and detritus, you know, like dead worms and stuff, get fed to the fish in the fish ponds, and then the fish are producing, you know, are also pooping in the water, and so that's sinking, and so the bottom of the fish pond becomes extremely fertile, and you periodically dredge out that mud and put it on the dikes, thereby completing the cycle and, you know, fertilizing those mulberry trees. And so it's, you know, it was described somewhat differently, you know, back in the day. You know, this is like a 16th century some of the sources, you know, the text sources that we have describing this practices are from the 16th century, and they describe it not in quite the same way that we do today, you know, because they had their own paradigm, right? They had their own things that they were thinking about. They were thinking a lot about profit, frankly. But nonetheless, it represents, you know, from us looking at it today, this looks like beautiful ecological wisdom, right? And it is. I mean, it does. It represents an understanding of the way the pieces fit together and the ways in which you can take the waste products from one area and use them, you know, in the same way that a forest ecosystem works, right? Or a pond ecosystem or any kind of ecosystem works, that, you know, instead of seeing it as kind of waste that has to be exported somewhere, it feeds another element, you know, of the system. And so there are many other, you know, kinds of examples actually in that that Ming Dynasty text that I've been looking at, they actually talk about having pigs above the pond. So they build on these like rafters, they build pig sheds above the pond. So the pigs stay cool because the water is cooling them. And then the pigs defecate and that goes into the water. And it feeds the fish. I guess actually it feeds them kind of more indirectly. It doesn't go into this in the text, but you know, it tends to cause like algal blooms. Like it's like algae and then the fish are eating that. But anyway, it contributes. It creates water that is productive for the fish. So there are all kinds of examples like that. And my main interest is actually not in the imperial era, but more in the socialist era. And in during the Mao era, they were trying, you know, all sorts of things. They were dealing with profound scarcity and trying really hard to transition the economy into a more productive state that could feed people and provide them with basic living necessities. And the one of the big kind of priorities or the philosophies that they adopted in order to make that happen was called integrated use, and zhonghe liyong in Chinese. And they would then kind of very much in that same spirit think, okay, so waste products are being produced in this one industry, how do we turn those into the raw materials for another, and kind of see the industries working as a larger system. So that, if you have sewage water being produced in urban areas or through, you know, factories, that water can then be used to raise fish in, or as a, you know, to fertilize agricultural fields, and or the waste products from the timber industry, you got to collect those all and make them into particle board, right? And the particle board would make it possible for people who had never had, you know, good furniture to have good furniture for the first time because it was, you know, affordable rather than imagining that the only way you were going to have furniture would be to have, you know, wood from actual trees. It'd be far too unaffordable to a way to actually make furniture for the people. So these are the kinds of ideas and practices that I've been looking at. Another place that has become really dear to my heart in recent years, I've gone there three times in the past few years, is a town in a village in northern China. So very, very different from that village, Feng's village. Feng's village is in the southwest, water, you know, a lot of water, rich, right, you know, rich soil and rice, you know, rice country. And this place is very different. It's very, very, very dry. It's in the Taihong Mountains, very rocky. Very steep land, and the people in that village and the surrounding villages, the story is that they came over the mountains to live there, you know, centuries ago because they were trying to avoid the taxes that the emperor, you know, had set. And so they went into this secluded place where they could kind of hide out, and there's not that much land that is flat. And so they had to figure out ways to survive in this place. And so they created these incredible agricultural terraces. So all up and down the hills, you know, if you tried to farm it without terracing, it just erodes, right? And meanwhile, it's too dry. There's just not enough rain. So creating these terraces they're spectacularly beautiful because they're made with all of these, you know, handmade with stones, you know, that are, you know, stonemasons shaping the stones so that they fit. Spectacularly beautiful, all up and down the hills. But you know, the ways in which this represents the treasuring of resources. So my friend, the person I'm closest to there, is a man somewhat older than me, who is, you know, born a peasant, grew up a peasant, doesn't have an advanced education of any kind, is very interested in history and has become a kind of local historian and has become quite respected among local officials and people and agricultural specialists, you know, seek him out for his knowledge of the history of the agricultural practices in this area. And he tells, you know, these stories about, you know, learning from his father. Like he tells a story of one time walking on a, you know, piece of land that had just been prepared for planting, and his father, you know, scolding him because of, you know, how he had kind of thoughtlessly, you know, as a child, just thoughtlessly trampled the soil, which is so precious. I mean, the soil is scraped together from, you know, the cracks of the rocks, and then every bit of, you know, fertilizer from, they use donkeys there to pull the plow. So the donkey manure and the human manure and, you know, every scrap of compost is treasured and placed on these terraces so that there can be some kind of soil. Otherwise, there's just no living soil that you can plant in. And the water, they say, you know, treasure the soil as though it were gold and the water as though it were oil. Oil, you know, I think really meaning like, you know, cooking oil, you know, is so precious. So the systems that they have developed over the centuries, you know, with the terraces that in these fields are watered only through rainwater, but the terraces manage to prevent that water from leaking away, right? And the terraces also manage, you know, in the occasional time that it floods. So this area is famous for 9 years of drought and 1 year of flood. It's very, you know, challenging, right? But so if it does flood, you don't want the soil all to get washed away. Mm. And there's the families all have, is it called a cistern, right? Like a thing, like a place where all the water gets collected. So like all of the gutters are connected to this. So when it, you know, rains on the roofs, the water goes down into the cistern, and that's where, you know, if you need water for any purpose, that's where it gets pulled out of with a bucket. You know, in the living room, you take the lid off the cistern and you pull up the water, and you're always looking at the level of the water, like, is it going to be enough, right? Mm-hmm. So every drop of it. So there are a lot of examples, many, many different kinds of examples, and I'm trying to pull these all together, and not to romanticize this, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about, you know, romanticizing it. It's really serious survival that we're talking about, and that I think we're facing as a planet, right? And so we do need to think about how we're going to learn.
That's curious, Sigrid, you talking about the treasuring of resources in that situation. As you said, China is a big country, because I think, like, I also have a stereotype of China as a producer, exporter of all these plastic disposable goods, pumping those out at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the time is getting short.
Wow.
you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. This is Sigrid Schmaltzer, my guest today, professor of Chinese history at UMass and history of science, and lives here in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Stay tuned for Democracy. No. Madness Radio coming up at 4 o'clock. Democracy Now! Comes up at 5. Sigrid, you have a bunch of notes there. I hope we talked about some of that stuff. Is there anything that you want to say before the time goes out? I have a few other announcements too.
Yeah, I feel like I talk too much about all kinds of other things. But this has been such an honor for me. I mean, I have admired the work that you do since I got here in the Valley in 2004. And for me, I mean, the Pedal People is always in my mind as I'm thinking through these big questions. And I have actually shown, you know, pictures of the Pedal People to my friends in China, to kind of connect, you know, what is more common, much more common there than is here, of people using bicycles to haul trash and this kind of thing. You know, the main question I get from people there is, you know, why people in a, you know, rich country like the U.S. who have access to cars would ever do that kind of work. So it's interesting and connected. And I find I am inspired a lot by the work that you guys do, and am always thinking about those questions. I feel very connected to that, and that it connects a lot to the stuff that I'm trying to think about when I go to China. So that's the only thing I think I really wanted to be able to say that I didn't somehow say before.
Well, you can tell them on your next trip that it's less stressful, it's funner, it's healthier, and we're still able to make a living.
That's right.
And it just feels more peaceful as a for our daily existence. And we're still able to make a living.
I will say that for sure.
Thanks. So thanks for listening to Out There today. Thank you so much for coming in, Sigrid.
Thank you.
Today's Tuesday. The Tuesday Farmers Market in Northampton is going on right now until 6:30. Do you know?
It could be 6:30.
Tomorrow's Wednesday, so the Florence Farmers Market will be happening from 2 until 6 by the Lilly Library in downtown Florence. And I'm going to play this song again. I love this song. This is Dumpster Flex. And I thought about this song yesterday when I was emptying compost at Valley Recycling, because when I opened that plastic dumpster lid, it said Duraflex on it. And I thought, oh, that's how Isaac Andreas, maybe that's how he got the idea for this Dumpster Flex song. This is Isaac Andreas.
Headed down to the dumpster with my Louis Vuitton. Sneak around with those sneakers that I found to put on. Nike Grappa is my outfit, cost low as they pass. And no, no commando, I got ego on my bum. My eBay account is my only degree. Yeah, I live off of trust, and that's what I believe. Truth is, it be as water, but the rest is your waste. It's just lucky you as waste is treasure to me.
Dumpster flex, dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster. trash. Now look at what I found just the other day. Now okay, why would someone go and throw this away? It's straight up new with tags, and it's never been worn. No stains, no marks, no smell, no dirt, no torn. It's a shirt, guys, they don't expire. Besides, expiration dates are made by liars. There's planned obsolescence in this whole expense. I'm diving daily here to give shirts like these just one more chance.
Dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster fresh. Dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster fresh.
Every morning I get up out of sheets I found. I brush my teeth every day, a new brush that I found. Get a shave with my razor, guess what we found. Wash my hair with shampoo that yup I found. Put on clothes that were lost and now are found. Eat my brunch, it's just cereal but it's free, I found. Pack a lunch from the mini fridge, all found. Hop on a really nice bike that I wish I found. Check my Craigslist app for the buyers I found. Watch TV on a couch of both the which I found. Grab some chai at the shop with the cards I found. Yeah, I think I get the point.
Is that too much?
Hey, no, I'm not a hoarder. I live my life with extreme order. When I get a good haul, I know I'm blessed. I give thanks to God for a bountiful harvest. Diving isn't just about error and trial. You see, diving is a full-on living lifestyle. Practice what you preach, please don't put it there. If my dumpster fashion catches you unaware.
Dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster fresh. Dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster fresh.
I got my ego from Eureka, you just think about that. Next time you trash on something, you best call me up stat. I want more competition just to pull them away. I am the predator, your dumpster the prey. I go dumpster diving, that's no metaphor. It's an art I mastered, so now I mentor. If you think you're better, then I challenge thee. A duel, loser must eat the 6-month old brie.
Dumpster flex. I wrote this song, it's so dumpster fresh.
One more thing from Sigrid before we go.
So one thing is there is an organization that we didn't mention that I'm involved in called the Critical China Scholars. This is an organization that takes a very critical eye on the anti-China politics of the United States, but without throwing our Chinese comrades under the bus who are fighting for labor justice and justice for Uyghurs and feminism, et cetera. And so if you want to check that out, it's at criticalchinascholars.org.
Thanks.